Hey, this is Photography in Society, their podcast by the Master Program under the same name at the Royal Academy of the Art in The Hague.
What does it mean to do research as a visual maker?
In what ways can research be conducted?
How can making things guide thinking processes and vice versa? These are some of the guiding questions behind Unstill, the season of our podcast focusing on the research processes and works of the graduates of 2023.
Memory, archive, technology, war, post-memory, mediation, AI, there is definitely machine learning in there. My name is Alexei Yurenev. My pronouns are he and him. I am originally from Moscow. I grew up there. Then I moved to New York when I was 16 years old and lived there for almost 20 years before coming to The Hague. In that time, I got into photography. Actually, this is crazy. It's 20 years ago almost. I saw this woman on a bus who had these black and white prints, and there were like these really beautiful blurry pictures. I never got her name, unfortunately, or her contact, but she told me, I was like, what is this? And she's like, oh, it's photography. I'm like, wow. It was incredible. It was just like a bunch of blurs. And then I was like, where do you do this? She's like, oh, in this darkroom. I was like, what's darkroom? I was like 16 or 17 years old. And then I went to this darkroom, and that was it. Then I worked I was in college studying psychology. Got a job as a photo assistant. I worked for a lot of advertising and fashion photographers in New York City. Then I became an advertising photographer myself. And in the meantime, I was, you know, photography kind of replaced my endless like nostalgia and missing home and like looking for a sense of home and a belonging in the New York context where I never figured out how to belong at that time. And I also couldn't go back to Russia because of the conscription in the army. So I had to wait 11 years before I returned. So by that time, flash forward, this is like 2014, 11 years of my absence from Russia. And I realized that I was already kind of getting bored with, not just bored, but just like the work was lacking some kind of substance. It lacked humility that I was, you know, making commercial work. And after returning to Moscow, it was kind of crazy to connect back to a place where you're from that you can't even recognize. So there was, in a sense, it was like a hallucination of a home, but you feel this belonging, but you don't belong there either. So it's like this eternal dislocation of identity and sense of home. And that just was like, okay, I have to document this. And that was kind of it. And then I followed advice of my friend. He's like, okay, just, you know, this is right when like Crimea got annexed. And he's like, just go and like, go look, you know, just take a camera and go, you know, and that's exactly what I did. And then shortly after got sucked into documentary and photojournalism. I was working on assignment for quite a big number of publications and then working slow for myself. My focus was Russia, Ukraine, and anywhere in post-Soviet Russian speaking world, because it's something I could connect to. But in that whole time, it was like, the central idea and search in my work was kind of looking for that sense of home that I could never get back. And it was like trying to find that place that reminds me in some way of what I remember, you know, this kind of dysfunctional place that is built in the memory of something really big that is still trying to find itself. It's like in this transitional state, because that's the state I remember growing up in Moscow in the 90s. Where everything was just really in flux, and it was like things were, you know, freedom was about, it was like extreme freedom, it was like anarchy, but it was like things were about to happen, and then they kind of never did. But as we can see right now, but you can laugh and cry about it at the same time. But that was exactly that feeling, you know. And frankly, it was just after working for all these years, it was COVID, and also got again, it was like hit the same wall of like when I. What was happening with me with advertising, that was just like, not that it was, my work was lacking substance and humility and some kind of a fulfilling element. It was more about working in a certain strategy. Like, you know, you're just like, you kind of repeat the same thing. Like I would just go in bed in this, like somewhere in the post-Soviet world and just like follow my gut, like just like walk around for a long time. And it wasn't like reflexive enough. And I just felt like there was so much more to photography at that time. and it was like a perfect storm of COVID, and then I also launched this publication with this mentor of mine that I studied under in ICP, and that was dedicated to visual strategies and innovation and what is new in this world. And then like the whole AI thing happened, and just being able to generate an image, I was like, well, what does that actually mean for photography? And then somebody told me about the program here at Maps, and it felt like a perfect place to like retreat and recalibrate my practice. My graduation work is a project that I've been working for 2 years before arriving to Maps. I've been working for it for 4 years. It's called Silent Hero, and it's what started out as an inquiry into family trauma and loss and void in family. But what triggered this kind of search was actually an emergence of technology. It was I went to a lecture of Fred Richin. Actually, I was in Moscow at the time. I was staying there for work, and he came there and he showed this project called This Person Doesn't Exist by Philip Wang. It's this website where one can go online, and with each refresh click of the browser, you're confronted with a synthetic portrait of a human, and it's endless. And it's all these people don't exist. And it's just the title of this website, thispersondoesntexist.com, immediately kind of made this connection with my grandfather's memory, which I know nothing about, of his time in the war, you know. And this was like a really odd connection to me, but I was just like thinking of like what doesn't exist in my life, that this all of a sudden we have this tool that is capable to imagine what doesn't exist. And it's funny, it's like with my grandfather was kind of funny, because in a way, you know, I grew up in Russia, and again, and there's a, you know, I was born in 86, and it felt like I was born, you know, war ended in 45, but it felt like it ended 2 weeks ago, you know, before I was born, because it was everywhere. The monuments, the films, the carnations, the photographs, you know, the parades, you name it. Like, it was just all over the place. And the expressions, like, oh, as long as there's no war, everybody's grandfather fought in the war, everybody's family lost a family member, everyone's affected, so everyone's impacted. So it's like you're reliving this post-memory of an event you'd never lived, but it's preventing you from having your own kind of narrative, right? So and with all of this abundance of information, I realized my grandfather's dead of 10 years, like, I never asked him about his time in the war, really, because it was just like, it felt redundant. And every time anybody attempted to ask him, he would either cry or make jokes. So then I just immediately, after like, you know, looking at This Person Doesn't Exist, I was like, okay, so let's do a little exercise here. How can I learn this technology? Granted, it was COVID, so it was like a lot of free time. At that time, tools were not as accessible, and you had to learn coding. I taught myself some math and Python, and learned how the machine learning works. And I started first looking at Family Archive. And Family Archive was interesting in certain ways, because like it was so precariously captioned, and you know, all the photos are made in a photo studio because photography was expensive. Most of the image making was dedicated to photo ateliers. And if you look at my Family Archive, it looks like World War II for my grandfather happened in a photo studio. And you know, because he's like presenting his glory and his, you know, outfits and uniform, and you know, and what actually happened at war is like remains in the shadow of like of that is casted of his body onto the background, you know. It's like it's completely obscure. And then you have letters, you know, in the Family Archive too, that are, you know, contents of them are questionable. Many are stamped with the censorships of the military censorship of Soviet Union, so you don't know what these weird, sometimes slipping through passages of you know, patriotic passages slipping through in these letters are actually written to my grandmother or to the person, the invisible censor, reading these letters. So this question of authenticity comes through. So then it's like they have this technology that is like responsible for deep fakes. I'm like, oh, can I flip it around and use this nefarious technology for something meaningful to me, which is the memory of my grandfather. So then I proceeded by training an image making model, again, a generative adversarial neural network, on a sourced archive of World War II images that I found online, that was assembled by like war fanatics and war aficionados, and that just put up random images they find. And they're like, okay, this tank is from this time, this uniform is from this time, so this is this battle. It's like this forensic amateur collection. And I didn't care what was in the images. For me, it was just important that they were from World War II, because for the machine, it's It doesn't matter if you have a tank, a child, a soldier, or, you know, a Nazi or Soviet. It's like, it's still, it's just, you know, it's all the same. And for me, it was like, this is a collective experience. I'm trying to delineate this one memory of war that my grandfather never talked about. So it was just like that, it kind of is a collective memory, you know, in this weird sort of way. So I made these data sets. It was one with like aftermath and battlefield, and the other one was with portraits of people. And to my surprise, I mean, over time when machines started functioning properly, like I started putting out images. To me, these images they're abstract, but they're still referential to the World War II archive that I personally digested along with the algorithm. So it's like I see it, it's like it doesn't have this, like it doesn't, it's almost stripped of its like medial surface. It doesn't have indexicality or iconicity of a photograph, but it also doesn't have this glory or anything else. So in a way, it's like it's like this flash under the skin. It's like it penetrates this visible spectrum into something else. Maybe I'm completely biased because I also consumed like, you know, tens of thousands of images training this machine, but when I look at them, I see war. And to verify my own perception of these images, I decided to create like another way of collaborating with another machine to see if we can, if I can engage a machine in this like act of looking. So I used Google Cloud Vision, which is a computer perception AI that, you know, is responsible for classification and sorting of everything you find on Google to define what these images are. And I put that image in, and many of them, and to my surprise, right away, it called them photography. There was no trace of that. It's like, oh, this is a machine learned photograph. This is not synthetic image. This is not AI. There's none of it. It says photography on all of them. And then it also sees military history. In some images, it sees soldier and military equipment. So it's like everything related. So it's like, it's what's so interesting about that, that the, you know, A, like, you know, the computer vision is just as subjective as human, but B, it's like it's able to kind of penetrate through that iconicity of photographs. Because this iconicity, this is what I was kind of, one of the main reasons I was trying to do is like, because I grew up with such an overabundance of all these war images and war memory, I wanted to create something I didn't see, you know? And also because like images, you know, like Evgeny Khaldei, the flag raising of Reichstag was taken a week late, completely staged, watch retouched, smoke added, and then, you know, the flag was made from tablecloths from, you know, TASS agency. Like it's like the authenticity doesn't even matter anymore. We're not even in that kind of a business here, you know? But I was, that part with the machine was like, first of all, it felt like a collaboration. And it's also felt like the machine is training me as much as I'm training the machine and trying to think with the machine instead of being just like, oh, here, like I'm just going to use this, you know, tech to try to do something. One more thing was really important to me because, like, you know, now there's all this debates. It's really interesting to be working with AI for like, it's funny. It's like I have a collaborator now who's helping me with the tech, and he calls my machine vintage. It's only maybe 8 years old, and he's like, this is, you know, vintage technology. And it's just like, it's in AI terms, it's Paleolithic, you know, but what it allows me to do is allows me to have full control over the data set. So at least I know what is inside of it. So it's not just images of, you know, random images of like landscapes or stolen images of celebrities or whatever mugshots it could be trained on. And there's like, and the labor is on me, you know? So it's like, there's no clean way of doing anything with images, but this is like my attempt of like trying to kind of even out the stakes here a bit and not just be like, you know, employing exploitative practices in some capacity. What happened next was because again, this was a collaboration, I was like, I wasn't sure who's training the machine. It was myself or I was training the machine or the machine was training me. And because it was like, oh, machine is like, oh, I need more data, basically. Because I was like, I'm not satisfied with results. And I, in search for more data, I discovered this archive that was recently declassified by the Ministry of Defense of Russia. And where you can put you can put a name of a person that fought in the war and learn everything about them. So I put my grandfather's name into this archive. And all of a sudden, from knowing nothing about him, I knew so much that I could, there's impossible to even digest in a lifetime, because basically it consisted of all his battle routes. With each battle route, with each step of his battle route, there was like a deluge of documents and data of like journals from the divisions, from the regiments, all the records of all the medals. And while I'm looking at it, you know, I remembered this one part where, you know, the reason why my grandfather went to the war a year before the conscription was because his brother was conscripted and disappeared. So I was, you know, I called my mother. I was like, hey, like, you know, I just found out everything about, you know, grandfather. And she's like, whoa, this is, you know, this is insane. This is like, wow, this is crazy. And it's like a picture of him. And then I'm like, wait, the brother. And he just like, you know, it's shaking, like nervous, you know, and they punched the brother's name. And I know nothing, like the brother's existence was defined by his absence. It was like this void in the family that, you know, just every war holiday, grandfather would like look at the plaques of names and the monuments, or they would just like sigh and cheers to, you know, the disappeared. And then all of a sudden he comes up, and yeah, he was killed. He was killed in outside of Stalingrad. His battle route was super short. It basically was enlisted only for like 3 months or 4 months at that time. But there's a place. And it was also mid-COVID. I couldn't travel. And it was like immediately, like I was like, first chance I get, I would go. And I went last year, right before the current war started, actually. It was, and then this project kind of, the project started dictating the next steps itself. So this is where like, it's interesting that the machine is like kind of pushed me to do something opposite of what, you know, doing synthetic or looking for something for that is authentic. And I find myself in Russia, in outside of Stalingrad, which is now Volgograd, following, you know, maps from like World War II and modern satellite imagery, trying to find the place where what his burial site is marked, which is pretty accurate. It was like, I mean, it said, I mean, I was kind of nailed it down to like couple square kilometers, which I think is pretty accurate, as accurate as it can be in this way of working. And then of course, I was like, okay, what is the opposite of generating, right? So I was like, okay, I'm going to take an 8x10 view camera, and I have all this like crazy like orthographic film, which is a specific type of emulsion that I ended up with, like this estate sale. and this film, what's interesting about it is because it wasn't really used for photographing that much. It was used for darker manipulations. So it's something that you put between the negatives to make an internegative or an interpositive for masking in the darkroom or for making copies of documents. And just that notion, it was like, can I put the substrate? And it's also, this film doesn't see what human recognizes as color red. It only works with UV light. It's not infrared, it's UV sensitive. So it's opposite of infrared. And for me, it was more of a gesture. I was like, can we take more, like I'm going to find myself in this field. I was like, it's a futile search for this. It's just as futile as looking for this memory that doesn't exist, you know, and that's just as futile as, I mean, it comes down to any kind of positivist way of measuring reality. But here I was like trying to measure the void. And can I measure the void? Can I strip away layers of reality to get to the play, to this other war memory that doesn't exist, but mediated through this really like photographic, you know, practice, you know. And it was nuts because I found myself in the prairies. It's like just, it's a white desert. It's the middle of winter, like minus 25 Celsius and wind blowing everywhere. You can't see anything, it's just white all around. So it doesn't matter really where I would point the camera. It would kind of produce the same picture more or less, you know, and it was just this flat line of a horizon. And it got really, you know, there's a lot of afterthinking happened because while I was there, the whole family is like, you know, I'm in touch with family and friends, and they're like, oh, do you feel anything? Do you feel any presence? I'm like, no, I'm like, I don't feel anything. But that's the whole point, because it's just, in a way, I think I succeeded. In a way, yes, I found myself in a battlefield, but I'm 80, like, you know, it's spatially accurate, temporally dislocated by 8 decades. And I'm photographing what it really is, you know, what is now. It's like, it's not an aftermath, it's present math, you know, it's not, it's completely different. But, and it's, and as much as I wanted to bring back my grand uncle, it's like, I just brought back his void in these images. And it's, but that was important, you know, it was, and it's, what's interesting is actually, like, I mean, this was a decision that came later with my images that I made with a GAN. I call them memories, you know, right? I call them, you know, battlefields or aftermath or war actors. But here I'm just using a GPS coordinate because for me it's there's a certain coldness to it. And what's interesting that the abstract images for that the GAN generated were much more, you know, they're Rorschachs, they're abstract, but they're much more evocative than these like flatline horizons. Although, you know, speaking of mediation, it's like, you know, if you're talking, you know, if you look at, you know, if we go back to like Flusser's idea of like, you know, what is a photograph is like a happening turned into an event of like, this is happening, 35,000 happenings compressed into this one event, 35,000 perspectives. And the field I was in, that was just white and empty, it had 2 million people under the snow that died in this battle. So in a way, it's like their compressed perspectives and lives and histories and that in this one, like abstracted into this flatness. But it's just, how do you... It's like the point of this project, I mean, overall, I mean, there's many other parts to it, but it's like the point, like the connecting line here is like, how can you generate proximity, you know, to something that, to a certain void in family history or family archive, state archive, etc. It's arguable what proximity is, but I think that I did achieve it in this last part, because the process was, you know, there's like a lot of painful thinking, like throughout, you know, they're trying to figure out where the project's going, and you know what, it's really enjoyable process, but it's also a really painful process because you do get stuck a lot. And it took me like a while to go back to. I went back to New York for holidays, and then it hit me that, you know, there's a Russian community that I actually photographed for a long time. Russian speaking community. And it's like one of the biggest in the Western Hemisphere in Brighton Beach, New York. And there is at this time, there were once, you know, in the 80s or the early 90s, there used to be 3,000 Red Army veterans that were part of that community. And today there are about 68 alive and 19 of them are turning 100 or more this year. So I decided to seize this opportunity and like, this is like the last time to actually hear the oral storytelling, you know, of this lived memory, like the before they, because you know when communicative like living memory is transferred to cultural memory, when it becomes in control of institutions such as archives and museums, it's, you know, it changes provenance. So then there's all these details are being brushed off. There's an invisible agent trying to decide what stays and what doesn't, and it's all like, what is worth archiving? And these are all really profound questions, and you know, things get really lost. So it's like, this is the last chance for me, at least, you know, maybe, you know, we'll see. And you know, remembering doesn't function without forgetting, especially when you're 100 years old, and especially when you've been used as like a fixture and a monument for all these years, and you're also brought up in a culture where, I mean, this is also why my grandfather never talked about his heroic acts. Yes, he had PTSD, but also there was this culture of silence. It was that there's this government narrative, and then true, there was a saying that true heroes keep their silence, and the ones that speak are embellishers and confabulators. So they only started talking about their stories maybe later on, like already like in their 70s or 80s. So of course, what time does to memory, we don't really need to get into that. It's explanatory, but also, you know, all your lived experience being like makes an impression on all these memories. And I came into these interviews already kind of completely open-minded and knowing that this is the reality, but it's just, it was more about, you know, a gesture and also a chance to actually hear it from the source. And to different degrees of forgetting, I was like, okay, this is, I'm going to see 100-year-olds. It's like 1900 years of remembering and forgetting. It's like, it's a really beautiful idea, you know, but, and in a way, I can't say that I got closer to war, even though some of these stories some people were really sharp, right? And there's one in particular, Alexander Rosenberg, who's 101 years old, and he's a fantastic storyteller. And he's just, the way his eyes were lighting up, he's just speaking so slowly, like saving his breath, but he's telling these stories. And it's like, you're listening to like Indiana Jones. This guy was like on a horse, shot in the foot, you know, there's an airplane flying by, shooting with the machine guns. I mean, it's wild. You're like watching these action movies, but it was not that. It was not really these facts that I could almost read in biographies or watch in movies. It was more about being in the presence of like a living monument. and also witnessing like everything, because I was filming, it was mostly video interviews. I did some stills, but I was just rolling a camera on a tripod. But everything that happened in between these interviews of like the watching the care, watching the, you know, the home attendant, the daughter, the wife, who's like, maybe there's like a wife and you know, she's not in a coma, but she's immobile. She's bedridden, but they keep her at home and they take care of her. So she's next to her husband, you know, and it's just, and their spouses and their children and just like this care. And I was like, I'm standing next to a person the same age as my grandfather would be, you know, and just being and touching them, like being in that was proximity, you know. And but it was a different, my role shifted from, you know, from a photographer to like to in this project, you know, from a photographer to, you know, researcher to critic of technology to like, you know, grandson of a veteran, and just, and then to this almost like a griot where these people are telling me that now you're in charge of carrying this memory. My grandfather, you know, because when, without telling me anything, the paradox of him was that every year on my birthday, he would call me and he's like, you know, you're the only grandson. And as the only grandson, you're in charge of carrying my medals and my memory. And I received the medals, but I didn't receive the memories. So that's what is like the kind of, that's when the search was also like that reflection on that idea was fueled this whole research. An experiment. I wanted to make this process collaborative, and also as I was verifying every image with the machine, as I was verifying every image with myself or my family, I wanted to bring in the veterans into the mix. So I started explaining to them how AI works, and I was started showing them the images, and I explained, was, I'm not trying to fool you, I'm like, this, you know, but this is fake, this is, you know, this is synthetic, this is based on the true story, based on the true images. And just like the machine, and just like myself, and just like some people, I would show these images to, they're like, oh yeah, this is a scene from a concentration camp. Oh, this is a picture of a soldier that was disfigured. You know, I've seen worse than that. You know, oh, this is a tank. This is a horse. And some of them would be like, oh, this is nonsense. You know, and then fair enough. You know, it is nonsense. But it was just, I really, that whole exercise was like reflecting. I was reading a lot of this philosopher from Hong Kong, and he writes a lot about technology and memory, and his name is Yu Kui, and he defined memory as something as to remember is when you it's about reconstructing the fragmented past and projecting into the future while you're in the present. So this kind of a spin of like, can you reimagine the future past, can, what is the you know, that, and bringing the actors of the particular part of history into the mix and bring and reintroducing this alternative future past to them, kind of showing what is their history possible without one stable defined catastrophic outcome, you know. And because there was like the whole, because it is about histories in the end, you know, it's about trying to create some kind of disruption in the stable historical narrative, and with the eye and all these, and together, there's all these methods of working. They form this methodology in a way of like trying to provide something, an alternative to like a singular historical narrative. And as we see now, unfortunately, I mean, this is also with the veterans. I was afraid to interview them because I didn't know how would they react and what they're consuming information wise, because, you know, the Russian propaganda is really strong. And now their memory and the image of these veterans is being used to justify this horrific invasion. And one after the next, they all condemned the war. And to my, you know, relief, and because it was like my biggest fear is like, how do I, you know, if I can I actually show this if they not, you know, it's like we'll be confronted with these kind of ethical choices. And thank God I didn't have to be confronted with that, because I didn't know what to decide. Because in a way, that's also a fair thing if that would happen as well. You know? And now, I mean, there's still like a couple of parts I'm still working through. Now I'm working on mostly on the output. I'm working specifically in book format. I'm one of the parts I'm making a graphic novel about this one day when my grandfather got a medal and my grandmother wrote him a poem while being photographed with her dorm roommates. And it's just this coincidence of this one date, and it's like AI images in the letter. Then I'm also recontextualizing a book by Ernst Friedrich called War Against War, where to like shockingly my the images of the soldiers that the machine has generated are have a striking resemblance to all the pictures of in that book. And I actually got a hold of his grandson, great-grandson of Ernst Friedrich's grand, and he allowed me to use the book. So I'm tipping in my images in there, that having being in conversation of this full open history. And what's interesting about that book in particular is that it was this anti-war pamphlet trying to stop all wars by showing violence. And as we see 100 years later, it didn't really help. But just like we see now, and so in this kind of cyclical nature of, you know, image and war and conflict and history is like kind of looping back in. It's almost like having, you know, that war carried this baby in the form of this, like, one of the machine images of the synthetic confabulations I've created to mix in. Sure. I mean, my practice right in general is about is looking into how technology shapes collective memory and how we produce knowledge. You know, so that's in a way of like my focus of kind of this, you know, sphere of my work and research. And in this project in particular, so I mean, what's interesting to me is like, and yes, there's it's about tools, it's about materiality, it's about technologies, but it's also about something personal. It's also about these absences, but it's the absences are the kind of this driving force. But what I'm trying to do here is like, there's in a few different ways. One of them is like create, like as I said before, is create this methodology consisting of many methods of like, can we, you know, disrupt this singular like postcard paradigm, this stable historical narrative. I've been invited a lot to speak about this project, specifically on focusing my AI portion of the work. And through these speaking engagements, I kind of narrowed down my audiences. And is and what's interesting to talk to, I think what's important to talk to around AI right now is not to even photographers, photography community is important, but more importantly, if we actually want to change something, we're talking to tech developers. Because it's that's the community that's actually, first of all, much more open than what I find photography community. That's not, they're not, because they don't, they're coming more naive in a way from, lack of a better term, lack of education, of like visual education like we have. But they are in charge of deploying the new systems. So in a way, what we're trying to do, like, you know, in the critical discourse is like trying to put out the fire, right, of like everything that's, but that's a reactive mode of working. A proactive mode of working is going to the place where they're inventing new technologies and be like, hey, like this was cool, this was not cool. And like, how can we make this that it works for us? Like trying to bridge this dialogue, because the other sector of my audience is photography and, you know, photography community and mainly in education, you know, and they're, and also, and within that community of like trying to be like, okay, as most, you know, a lot of the discourse is about panic is like, oh, your work's being automated. How do we know it's true? It's not. It's not about what's true and not. What are the creative ways of using this technology? And I think there's a lot. And a lot of it starts when we stop thinking about it in photographic terms. We shouldn't be talking, you know, like about 21st century medium in 20th century terms. And it's like, can we evolve that conversation? So that's what I'm trying to affect with that. And also in the third audience that I'm looking at is the ones that whose history is affected. Like I'm trying to see, you know, right now, I've given a lot back to the veteran community. I'm screening the film with them. I'm in contact trying to, you know, figure out working with some foundations that preserve their memory and trying to find different ways. Because, I mean, how many there's the World War II memory is usually filled with, like, you know, you see the same image, the same modes of celebration. And now it's the time, I think, for especially from the side of Russia, where that memory is being used for weaponized for to justify invasion. Can you flip this somehow? Can you show by using these technologies and methods, kind of creating a different narrative that will transcend a story that is in form of the personal story of me trying to find, embarking on this journey and trying to find these voids and memory and showing the absurdity of all of it, because this is a futile attempt of they're all, everything fails, but, you know, proximity is there through contacting with the living. Can we just, you know, it's not a pacifist manifesto, but it's some form of like, is there another way to talk about this?
Thank you for listening to Unstill, a season of Photography and Society, the podcast by the master program under the same name at the Royal Academy of the Art, The Hague.
If you are curious to hear more about the research processes of the graduating students of 2023, listen to the remaining episodes from this season.
This season was designed and produced by Sophie Allerding
and Emilia Martin.